Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Great to be back.
Today, we're going to explore something really intricate, often overlooked, the connections between Armenians and Kurds.
Yeah, it's a long, complicated history, centuries of it.
We've got sources covering, well, coexistence, conflict, even cooperation sometimes.
Our aim is really to unpack this relationship, Ottoman times, the 20th century, right up to today.
Highlighting those key moments, the nuances you often miss in the bigger picture.
Exactly. We'll touch on socioeconomic stuff, empires, the Armenian genocide, a huge factor, obviously, and the different roles Kurds played there.
And then bring it up today. Turkey, Iraq, Syria, Iran, Armenia itself, the diaspora, too.
It's a wide scope, but essential to understand the dynamics.
So let's start back in the Ottoman Empire. Armenians and Kurds living side by side for centuries, especially in the east.
Right. But with different ways of life, often. Armenians were largely settled farmers, artisans, merchants.
Whereas many Kurdish groups were nomadic or semi-nomadic. Pastoralists, mostly tribal.
That geographical closeness led to, well, a kind of interdependence. Armenian skills, their produce were important.
And Kurdish communities sometimes relied on them.
They did. But it wasn't equal. It was within a hierarchy.
Where Muslim Kurds generally had a dominant position over Christian Armenians, the Raya.
Yes, and that imbalance, it led to exploitation. You hear about raids by Kurdish tribes on Armenian villages.
And taxation by local Kurdish chiefs that, well, felt like extortion.
Some accounts even paint it as almost feudal, a dependency.
It's crucial to remember that Ottoman context, isn't it? The Raya status.
Absolutely. Fewer legal rights for non-Muslims. Inherently more vulnerable. That's the backdrop.
But even with those inequalities, there were mechanisms for getting along locally.
Yes, there were. Mm. Kirvelik or Kirivati is a fascinating example.
That's the ritual kinship thing. Sponsorship maybe at circumcision.
Exactly. Creating these lifelong bonds between specific Armenian and Kurdish families.
People sometimes point to it as proof of past harmony, but...
Well, it existed within that unequal system. It didn't erase the discrimination.
So maybe more of a local strategy. Building alliances, managing that interdependence.
That seems likely, yeah. A very human way to navigate a difficult social structure.
Then things shift. Late 19th century, nationalism rising, Ottomans trying to centralize.
Which disrupted Kurdish autonomy, remember. They felt squeezed, too.
And Armenian political awareness grows, demands for reform, often with European backing.
Which makes Sultan Abdulhamid II nervous. He goes for a divide-and-rule strategy.
Leading to the Hamidi Light Cavalry in 1891.
Primarily Kurdish tribesmen, armed and supported by the state.
Officially, they were for border protection, right?
That was the line, yes. Hmm. But their main role quickly became harassing and attacking Armenian communities.
Intensifying exploitation, double taxation, land grabs, all with government backing.
It basically institutionalized the violence, made things much, much worse, deepened the animosity.
This is a real turning point, isn't it? The state actively weaponizing one group against another.
Absolutely. And it directly feeds into the Hamidian massacres.
1894 to 96, horrific events, a precursor to the genocide.
Estimates range from 100,000 to maybe 300,000 Armenian deaths.
Carried out by Ottoman forces, often with Kurdish irregulars and these Hamidi units.
And frequently triggered by Armenian resistance to that exploitation, like the Sansun resistance in 1894.
So resistance led to massive state violence.
Yes, and crucially, it showed the state was willing to use mass violence against Armenians and use Kurdish forces to help do it. A chilling precedent.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roach Bosch Hannah.
Ah, perfect timing.
This smells fantastic today. A lovely hint of cardamom. It's not too bitter, just the right balance.
Smells wonderful.
A little sugar will bring out the sweetness perfectly. Let's take a quick break to enjoy this chai.
Okay, welcome back. Hope you enjoyed that little pause.
Refreshed and ready.
So we were talking about the Hamidian massacre setting a precedent. Then comes World War I and the Armenian genocide, 1915 to 1923, orchestrated by the Young Turk government, the CUP. Their ideology was radical nationalism, wanting to homogenize the empire.
While the state planned it, certain Kurdish groups did participate in the massacres, deportations, the looting.
Yes, their involvement came through different channels. Some were in the regular army or the Hamidi. Others were encouraged by this special organization, the Teskilat Masusa, to attack deportee convoys.
Do the sources distinguish between different Kurdish groups?
They suggest nomadic tribes might have been more involved than settled villagers, but it's complex.
There were brutal events, like the Tigris massacres near Diyarbakir,
where Kurdish chieftains were apparently directly recruited by the governor for the killings.
But it's crucial to stress, this wasn't universal Kurdish behavior, right?
Absolutely not. Participation wasn't uniform at all. It was influenced by state coercion, opportunism, old tribal rivalries, religious factors, perceived self-interest, a whole mix of things.
And importantly, some Kurds actively resisted the genocide. They protected Armenians, risking their own lives.
That's a vital part of the story. The Kurds of Dersim, for example, are often credited with saving tens of thousands, offering refuge.
Yazidi Kurds, too, they offered protection.
Yes. And the motivations varied there as well. Pre-existing good relationships, opposition to the CUP government.
Sometimes financial incentives, like smuggling people to safety.
That happened. Also, tribal self-interest protecting Armenians, seen as somehow theirs, and simple altruism, basic human decency.
These acts really challenge any simple narrative of universal Kurdish complicity.
Completely. They show agency, moral courage, defying the state's orders, a powerful counter-narrative.
The consequences of the genocide were just devastating. Near total destruction of Armenians in their historic homeland.
In a huge demographic shift, Kurds moved into areas that were formerly Armenian.
Leaving this terrible legacy of confiscated property, enduring trauma for Armenians.
And for Kurds, the memory is complex. You see denial in some quarters, but also guilt, a sense of loss among others.
And arguably, the impunity for the genocide paved the way for later repression against other groups.
Including Kurds themselves. That's a point many observers make.
After World War I, there was a brief moment of hope. The Treaty of Sevres in 1920.
Yes, it actually included provisions for an independent Armenia and autonomy for Kurdish areas.
Bohos Nubar Pasha for the Armenians and Sharif Pasha for the Kurds even agreed on cooperation at Versailles.
A potential alignment. But it didn't last.
The Turkish nationalist movement under Ataturk rejected Sevres entirely.
Leading to the Treaty of Lausanne in 1923. That established the modern Turkish Republic.
And wiped away the promises of Sevres. Kurdish lands were divided between Turkey, Iraq, Syria, Iran. No minority status for Kurds in Turkey.
A huge setback for both national aspirations.
But that shared denial, being denied their national rights, it actually fostered some attempts at cooperation against the new Turkish Republic.
Right, like the Koyban organization, founded in 1927.
Aimed at Kurdish unity, and it got support from Armenian groups like the ARF.
Koyban backed the Ararat Rebellion, 1927 to 1930, a major Kurdish uprising.
Which was eventually crushed by the Turkish state.
Yes, but that cooperation, even though it failed, showed a kind of pragmatic alignment, a common enemy. It even involved some Kurds who'd previously been hostile to Armenians.
Then comes the Kemalist Republic's policies in Turkey. Aggressive Turkification.
Suppressing non-Turkish identities. Mm-hmm. Armenians, Kurds, everyone else.
Both groups faced forced assimilation, denial of their existence, language suppression.
Cultural suppression, forced resettlement, violent crackdowns. The Dersim massacre against Kurds in the 1930s is another example.
And this shared experience of subjugation, over time, it reshaped Kurdish perspectives.
It seems so. Growing empathy for Armenians, recognizing a shared victimhood under Turkish state violence. That becomes really significant later on.
Okay, let's shift to more contemporary relations. They vary a lot by region, don't they?
Hugely. Look at Turkey first. There was a significant shift within the Kurdish political movement, particularly from the 90s onwards.
Towards acknowledging the Armenian genocide and Kurdish complicity.
Yes. You saw activists, parties like the DTP and later the HDP issuing apologies. Prominent figures, too.
People like Ahmet Turk, Selahattin Demirtas, even Abdullah Öcalan from prison.
Publicly recognizing the genocide. Kurdish NGOs formally acknowledged it, too. There was a period of memory work.
Restoring Armenian churches, creating monuments, trying to foster dialogue.
But that faced a backlash. And it declined sharply after 2015 with the renewed conflict in the southeast and general state repression.
And the state even started using anti-Armenian rhetoric against Kurds, didn't it?
Yes, trying to drive a wedge again, linking Kurdish aspirations to Armenian historical claims. A disturbing echo of the past.
What about in Iraq? The KRG, the Kurdistan Regional Government.
There, the relationship with Armenia is much more formal and cooperative. Mm. There is an Armenian consulate in Erbil, regular high-level meetings.
What's driving that partnership?
Shared geopolitical interests, mutual empathy, perhaps. Mm. Both see threats from regional actors, particularly Turkey.
And the KRG has been seen as a relative safe haven for Christian minorities generally.
Compared to other parts of Iraq, yes. So cooperation covers diplomacy, economy, culture, even some security aspects.
Then Syria. The civil war led to Rojava, the AAzines.
The Autonomous Administration of North and East Syria. Armenians have participated in its structures and in the SDF, the fighting force.
There's the Martar Nubar Azanian Brigade, for instance, driven by shared threats from ISIS and Turkey.
And you also see crypto-Armenians, people whose families hid their identity after the genocide, starting to reclaim it in that context.
But it's not all straightforward. There are reports of tensions.
Yes, between the dominant PYD party and some minorities, including Armenians. Plus, the AANEs faces huge external threats, especially from Turkey, and internal governance challenges. It's a very precarious situation.
And Iran, what's the dynamic there?
Different again. Mm-hmm. Armenians and Kurds are both minorities, but with very different histories and relationships with the Iranian state.
Armenians have a long history, quite integrated into Persian society.
Whereas Iranian Kurds have often been in conflict with the central government over autonomy demands. So significant Armenian-Kurdish cooperation within Iran seems quite limited, based on our sources.
What about Armenia itself, the state's relationship with Kurdish populations?
It's mainly defined by the Yazidi minority in Armenia,
who are historically and linguistically related to Kurds, but there's a debate about identity.
Yes, a strong movement within the Yazidi community asserts a distinct ethno-religious identity, separate from Kurds.
How does the Armenian state handle that?
It recognizes both Yazidi and Kurdish as minority languages. And there's guaranteed parliamentary representation for Yazidis.
So despite the identity debate, Yazidis have a distinct cultural presence.
Very much so. And they participated alongside Armenians in the Nagorno-Karabakh wars. The recent loss of Nagorno-Karabakh, that could influence regional dynamics going forward, though it's hard to say how yet.
Let's talk about non-state groups. The PKK and Es-Sala, the Armenian militant group, were their links?
Sources suggest ties in the late 70s and 80s, based on shared anti-Turkish sentiment, shared leftist ideologies back then.
Well, kind of cooperation.
Things like joint press conferences, some claimed joint attacks, apparently shared training camps in Lebanon's Beka Valley, and maybe Iraq. Personnel exchange, even.
And Öcalan, the PKK leader, endorsed Es-Sala ideologically for a time.
He did, but disagreements arose, particularly over tactics. Es-Sala's targeting of civilians was controversial, and Es-Sala itself fragmented.
So the cooperation faded.
It seems so, though the Turkish stiff narrative still tries to link the PKK to Armenian interests today.
Contemporary claims of joint activities, say in the recent Karabakh conflicts, need careful checking then.
Absolutely. Often part of disinformation campaigns.
What about the diaspora, Armenian and Kurdish communities living abroad?
Complex interactions there, too, marked by the historical trauma of the genocide, political divisions within each group, strategic thinking.
Are there attempts at rapprochement, building bridges?
Yes, goodwill gestures happen. But there are also, understandably, lingering negative feelings from the genocide and the role some Kurds played.
And Kurdish diaspora groups often quite fragmented themselves.
They sometimes see potential in alliances with the more established, influential Armenian diaspora.
And Armenians might see strategic value in backing Kurdish aspirations against Turkey.
Potentially. But Kurdish disunity is a factor, and different priorities within both diasporas hinder really deep collaboration often.
Finally, let's touch on culture. There's a shared heritage there, isn't there? Especially music.
Oh, absolutely. Similarities in melodies, themes, even instruments. You have iconic ethnic Armenian musicians like Karapeti Saso and Aram Tigran, who became giants in Kurdish music.
And Kamitas, the great Armenian ethnomusicologist, he researched Kurdish melodies too.
He did. And Radio Yerevan, during the Soviet era, was vital. It broadcast in Kurdish and helped preserve Kurdish music when it was suppressed in Turkey.
What about literature?
Modern Kurdish literature increasingly engages with the Armenian genocide, exploring that lost coexistence, sometimes drawing parallels with Kurdish suffering.
Soviet Armenia was important for Kurdish literature too, wasn't it?
A crucial center for its early development, yes. This intertwined history is baked into the culture. Place names, oral traditions about the Armenians leaving, about the genocide.
So as we wrap this up, it's clear this relationship is incredibly layered. Coexistence, conflict, cooperation. It's all in there.
Definitely a multifaceted tapestry. And the shadow of the Armenian genocide is huge. A stark reminder of state violence and the complex roles communities can play.
But there's also resilience, emerging movements towards recognition, maybe reconciliation, offering some hope.
Though the current geopolitics keep shaping things dramatically. Turkey, Iraq, Syria, it's all still very much in flux.
Yet those cultural connections, the music, literature, shared memories they endure, a testament to centuries of living together somehow.
It leaves us with big questions, doesn't it? How did these two ancient peoples navigate this shared past, chart a future in such a volatile region?
That really is the critical question. What aspects of this history resonate most with you listening to this? What other questions does it raise for you about accountability, reconciliation, or maybe the potential for solidarity across ethnic lines when facing these huge challenges?
We really encourage you to keep exploring this vital topic. There's so much more to understand.